Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, December 1st. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner. We'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Cindy, I want to start with a really nice story you did this week, shining some light on what's happening at a homeless shelter in Hyannis, focusing on the large percentage of older citizens who find themselves homeless.
It's called the graying of the homeless population, and this is something that's happening across the state, but it's a cause for particular concern on the Cape, which has an older population in general, about 30% of Barnstable County, 65 and older, compared to 16% across Massachusetts. Now, at St. Joseph's House Shelter in Hyannis, which used to be known as the Noah Shelter, now it's run by the Fall River Catholic Diocese, and then since November, they say that 89 people, 55 and older, which is 34% of their population, have entered the shelter's doors, and some with canes and walkers.
So a population that's older must pose a whole new set of challenges, or very specific challenges for a homeless shelter.
Yeah, they have special needs. They need to go, they have a lot of medical appointments, and they'll need to sleep, for instance, on the bottom bunk a lot of times because of mobility and balance issues. Sometimes there's issues with incontinence. And also, Karen Reddy, who's the shelter coordinator, said that she'd like to, you know, older people to have the opportunity to take a nap in the afternoon for 20 minutes, but they just don't have the staff to be able to provide that for them. And she said that she also, the Catholic, Fall River Catholic Diocese runs several shelters in southeastern Mass. And for instance, in New Bedford, during that same time period that I mentioned earlier, only 15% of shelter residents were 55 or over. That was 42 compared to 89 in Hyannis.
And so they also have some special transportation needs for these folks?
Yes. Actually, Karen Reddy got money from the diocese to buy two minivans that she just got them just about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, to take people to medical appointments. And that just made life so much easier. They were actually having, you know, it cut down on their emergency calls. People were, you know, dialing 911 for an earache and that sort of thing. And now they can just, it just makes everything so much easier. They can just make an appointment, bring them to the doctor, drop them off, pick them up when the appointment's over.
I thought you also went on to detail some of the difficulty that older people have in accessing even the care as housing becomes a problem for them.
Right. Well, there are many the different towns, many dozen or so housing authorities across Cape Cod, but they all, and many of them have senior public housing. But the problem is you have to go to all the different housing authorities to apply for housing. This is a problem for young people too, but it's a particular problem for older people who just might not have the mobility to be able to get around to all these different housing authorities or figure out the whole system. And so the state, Paula Schnepp, who's a housing advocate on the Cape, said the state is trying to at least work to make it easier, just create one portal where you put in one application, it goes to all the authorities, you're on the waiting list. She says there's still a huge need for housing for people who are seniors and low income and all across all ages, including seniors. But at least this will make it easier for people to access what's there.
And also there are mental health issues that come up sort of as a result of being homeless, an older homeless person.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because we know that many of the homeless population has mental health issues and substance abuse issues. But Karen Reddy at St. Joseph's House said among the elderly people, they're less likely to have substance abuse issues and also less likely to have these severe mental illnesses that put people out in the streets. However, they do get very depressed from being anxious from being homeless and not knowing where they're going to put their head at night. It creates a situation of anxiety.
It's an issue that you can see has so many moving parts, it must be difficult for them to really get their arms all the way around.
Right. But the state is, Cape officials did participate in a symposium and helped organize a symposium in Wareham in October. And so they feel that just by coming together and, you know, talking about the problem, let's start to doing something about the problem. And I talked to one older lady, Maggie. She's 60, but she's now in housing, not senior housing, but she's in public housing now. But she said when she went to St. Joseph's, the police brought her and her daughter there. They were evicted from the rental house. She was just had a hard time sleeping on the hard mattress because of her age. And so she'd get up after a while and just sleep in a chair in the TV room. And she has, you know, and like many older people, she has multiple multiple medical issues, for instance, spinal stenosis, fibromyalgia, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So it's really imperative for her to get a good night's rest.
A battery storage system built by the company Tesla could be providing backup power on Nantucket as soon as next year. I guess this demonstrates how far battery backup systems have come.
That's right. National Grid. This would be National Grid's first large-scale battery storage system, and it would be right here on the island of Nantucket. Construction on the battery is expected to begin this spring at National Grid's site near Nantucket Memorial Airport. Now, this battery will be paired with a diesel generator, and will kick into gear if the existing electrical supply on the island should ever fail.
How does the electrical supply work right now?
Well, Nantucket receives power through two underwater cables that connect to the Kate's transmission system, and it goes obviously 30 miles out to sea, and there is talk about building a third transmission line sometime in the future. But in the meantime, this hybrid backup system would work if any of the cables should fail.
And explain for us a little bit about how this battery system works. It's lithium batteries, I imagine?
It's lithium batteries as like you have in a cell phone, except so much more power. Like an official said, it's the equivalent of thousands of cell phones. So it's new. It's kind of a new application of technology. Taryn Hill, who's the National Grid's Director of Network Strategy, called the backup system an innovative approach. National Grid officials did not give a price tag for the project, but they said if the project has any effect on consumer rates, it would be negligible.
And they're expecting the construction to begin, looks like, in spring of 2018.
In spring, although the actual diesel generator, the construction has already, the work has already begun on that. But the battery itself will be, the work will start in the spring of 2018.
And wrapped up before the end of 2018. We're going to talk right now with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Morning.
Sarah, the Edgartown police chief is stepping down, and it's almost like an epidemic on the island, huh?
It really is, yeah. Fully half of the island police chiefs have either stepped down or announced they're stepping down in the last month. And the most recent one, as you said, is the Edgartown police chief, David Rossi. This week he announced that he would be stepping down because he had a heart attack 2 weeks ago. You know, he went to the hospital off-island, had a stent put in. That it was a real, you know, roller coaster ride for him. And on Monday, he came before Edgartown Selectmen to ask them to begin the process of putting him on disability retirement. You know, he said there are physical requirements for his job, also that he thought a lot about what's important, and it's important for him to be around for his family. He's going to have his first grandchild in January. So he is stepping down, and Selectmen approved that request. And as for the department, the lieutenant there, Chris Dolby, has been named acting chief while they look for a new chief. And both the former chief Rossi and Selectman said he would be their pick to lead the department. He said he's not, he doesn't want the permanent job. He's not ready for that yet. So they're setting up an assessment committee, and former chief Rossi will be on that committee to look at what going forward. But as you said, there are six police departments, so one for each town on the island, and three have announced their retirement in the last month, and four, this is the fourth in a year. At the beginning of this month, the Edgartown chief, David Rossi, his brother is the chief in West Tisbury, mm-hmm. Daniel Rossi. He announced that he was going to be retiring next year, earlier this month, and he has suggested a replacement, Lieutenant Matt Mincone, so there's kind of a succession, it looks like, potentially in place there. Over in Tisbury, Dan Hanavan, the chief there, has announced that he will be retiring also next year, so they are looking for a new chief there. And as I said, a year ago, the Chilmark police chief, Brian Chofee, stepped down and was replaced in March by Jonathan Clarain. So a lot of change on the mm-hmm. island police departments, and you know each town will kind of handle it all differently. But it's also three of the bigger police departments on the island, so certainly a big change for a lot of the law enforcement here.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
We're going to speak now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, Chatham Selectmen got a look at a proposal for a new shellfish upwelling building, and I think they were a little startled maybe by the price.
Yeah, they were. Now, what we're looking at is a property that the town purchased in 2014. It's a small parcel of waterfront land on Bridge Street, right next to the Mitchell River Bridge. The town bought it for $800,000 with the idea of eventually developing it to provide commercial and recreational access to Stage Harbor, as well as possibly move the town's upwelling, shellfish upwelling system over there. Now, last week, these conceptual plans that were drawn up by three town waterway committees went before the board, and it called for a number of improvements, one of which was a new shellfish upweller to replace the aging shellfish hatchery the town has at Old Mill Boatyard, where the harbor master's office is. Now, the plan also calls for a pretty large building with an accessible observation deck kind of all the way around it, surrounded by a series of piers and floats for boats to tie up on. The proposal also calls for a new bulkhead and also new facilities for commercial fishing vessels to offload their catches. Now, town officials and residents had a number of problems with this proposal. Like you said, Steve, starting with the $4 million price tag.
It's very ambitious, all the different parts that you just described.
It is, and that's kind of what the selectmen concluded, that this was a little too far of a reach for this property at this time. Now, that the money, it's not so much the fact that the money's not available. This past May, the town passed an $11 million bond issue to fund waterfront infrastructure. So the money is part of that proposal, but the $4 million price tag is a little more than they had anticipated. And nobody argues that there isn't a need for a new upwelling system. The shellfish, Chatham has probably the largest commercial shellfishing industry on the Cape, and it's supported by this grow-out facility that's been going on for quite a few years. But another problem is the visual impact of the way this is proposed, the building that they're proposing. If you recall, a few years ago, the state and federal government spent $14 million on a new Mitchell River drawbridge, and this proposed building would be parallel to the drawbridge, built off on a pier, sort of obscuring a large part of the view of the drawbridge. So that sort of drew the criticism from some of the historic preservation people who had fought hard to keep the Mitchell River drawbridge looking, you know, a wooden bridge and looking the way it has for the last 100 years. So what happened this past week was selectmen ended up sending this project back to the committees to be downscaled with a focus on the upwelling building, scaling it back, making it a little more fit in better with the site, and also you know, maintaining some kind of public access there, maybe saving some of these other aspects of the project for a later date.
Mm-hmm. So we'll have to wait and see how that what size it comes back at next, huh?
Indeed, yep.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we're going to hear from Ann Wood at the Provincetown Banner. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker, and joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner. Cindy, the National Seashore, Cape Cod National Seashore, is proposing a rate increase, particularly for pedestrians and bicyclists. They want to more than triple the daily entry fee. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this fee hike is being proposed for next summer. The National Park Service proposes to increase the daily entrance fee for pedestrians and bicyclists from $3 to $10. Motorcyclists would pay $15 instead of $10. If you're in a car, that rate would stay the same at $20.
So this is a big jump. Did they say, explain for us why they need this money?
Well, the acting superintendent of the Cape Cod National Seashore, that's Sean Mulligan, said that this will be seed money for improvements that are critical to the parks. The Cape Cod National Seashore collects about $2 million per year in entrance fees, and they get to keep 80%, and 20% goes into this national pool. They can compete for the money in this pool. For instance, they got money for a $5 million Heron Cove beach house project for the Red Maple Swamp Trails. And this will increase that pool of money that's available to them for the what they say are very necessary improvements. It's also an attempt by the Secretary of the Interior to standardize entrance fees across the National Park Service, according to Mulligan.
So it's been $3 for people who walk into the park or arrive on bicycles. They want to raise it up to $10. When was the last time they raised a fee for these folks?
That $3 charge for pedestrians and bicyclists has been in place since 2002, and there are sure to be some outcry this time. As you mentioned, they've more than tripled the proposal to pay triple. So there are, you can make comments. You can go to the National Park Service Planning, Environment, and Public Comment website and comment until January 5th, and let your feelings be known.
So it's the website one more time for folks who want to comment on this. The National Park Services
Planning, Environment, and Public Comment website.
Very good. We are going to speak now to Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Ann.
Hi, Steve. How's it going?
It's going well, Ann. Ann, a politically slanted kind of vandalism has appeared in Provincetown, and it's gotten a lot of people upset. This is quite a story. Tell us what's happening.
This is really odd for Provincetown. Believe it or not, there's someone in Provincetown or someone visiting Provincetown or someone who lives nearby who doesn't like Democrats or LGBTQ equality, apparently. Last week, five cars were all in the east end of town, were defaced by silver spray paint. Not the cars themselves, but bumper stickers on them that were touting President Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, State Senator Julian Sear, who lives in Truro, and LGBTQ rights stickers and equality stickers. Now, the first person that found this out or who notified the police about it was the artist Marion Ross. She found that three of her bumper stickers had been spray painted on November 20th in the parking space near her home. Provincetown Police Sergeant Glenn Enos had this bumper cleaner, this spray paint stuff in his car that removed it, graffiti wipe, a defacer eraser. And so he removed it from everybody's car stickers that were defaced. But 2 days later, somebody came by and peeled off the stickers.
They just took the stickers right off.
They did, or he did, or she did. I imagine it's a he, could be a she, could be more than one person. I don't know, but it was the same five cars. The stickers were then peeled off. So Rick Hines, a resident here, has put out what he calls a bounty on the head of the bumper sticker vandal.
What does this mean, a bounty on the head? Tell us.
So he offered a $1,000 reward for anybody leading to the person who's been defacing the bumper stickers and peeling off the bumper stickers. And then online, that had been upped to $2,200 when other residents, put money in the pot for it. Now, the thing is, everybody's pretty sad about it because the people who had their cars, their bumper stickers spray painted and then peeled off were uncomfortable because it happened literally on their doorstep. The car was right outside, and it made them sad because this is such an open and welcoming town. Marion Ross said that, she's angry about Trump, but when you take the next step that pushes anger into action, it becomes really scary. So people in town think it's a bizarre thing. They hope to find the person who did it or people who did it, and we'll see what happens.
Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner. Ann, thanks for checking in with that story.
Have a good weekend.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times is with us here. And Cindy, quite a bit more money is going to be coming to the Cape to help fund transit agencies here. In some ways, this is a bit of an accounting trick that made this happen.
Yeah, ferry passengers have been added to the Cape annual tally of modes of transportation, and that means additional federal funds for the Woods Hole, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket Steamship Authority and the Cape Cod Regional Transportation Authority. They get to split an additional $3.1 million.
So $3.1 million is going to come to the region, and it's going to be directed how?
We'll be going to those two different transit agencies, and they'll use the money. The ferry line says they're going to use the money for maintenance, capital needs, and other projects. Now, the ferry line was added to these regional. How this additional money came about is the ferry line was added to the regional calculations for urban area transportation funding. That's what's called urban area transportation funding, although we don't consider ourselves real urban area, but that's how it's designated by the Federal Transit Administration. They have a formula that looks, for instance, at passengers carried and miles traveled in a zone. They call it an urbanized zone, but it includes all of Barnstable County and a small area off the Cape. And the Steamship Authority has carried quite a few passengers. For instance, in 2016, according to its annual report, it carried 3.1 million passengers.
3.1 million passengers on the Steamship Authority ferries.
Right. And also last year, the Transit Authority carried 1.4 million passengers on Cape-wide bus lines. So that's a So that's a lot of transportation going around on the Cape.
Let's turn to a story about Cape Wind, the more than 10-year-old proposal to build 130 wind turbines in Nantucket Sound. It continues to generate news. I think many people considered the project dead, but that's not strictly true.
Yeah, dead in the water.
Yeah.
But the opponents do not want it to ever be the ever have a possibility of being revived. And so they have appealed a federal agency's decision to allow the Cape Wind to hold its long-term lease on Nantucket Sound. And the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound has filed an appeal November 21st with the Interior Board of Land Appeals.
So the group Cape Wind continues to hold a lease on this land in Nantucket Sound where they could potentially do something. The advocates working against that are trying to get that lease to be given up or the government
right.
To repeal
that.
Yeah,
the offshore wind, Cape Wind had planned to build 130 wind turbines there. And there's concern, though, that in this project, just the contracts have expired or were negated that were going to allow them to produce energy there. So this project is a no-go at this point. And there are companies that want to establish wind farms south of the islands, which are far less controversial. But the Alliance to Protect the Sound is saying that, well, we really want this. We want to know that this is gone forever. We want to know there's like no possibility of it for it to ever, you know, for it to become a possibility.
Well, the lease is run well into the future, I think until 2041, maybe.
Yeah, the lease is valid through 2041. Now, Audra Parker, she's the CEO and president of the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound, said as long as Cape Wind has a lease, Nantucket Sound is vulnerable to development. And so they said they really need to remain vigilant, and they apparently don't want to have to remain hypervigilant until 2041. They would like this to be done.
And there's a broad support of groups that are part of this appeal, too.
Yeah, it includes the town of Barnstable, and there's something called the Massachusetts Competitive Partnership and the Massachusetts Fishermen's Partnership.
Cindy, the Cape could be getting its first memorial to the Vietnam War. There's an effort underway in Sandwich to make this happen.
The effort is being spearheaded by four veterans from the American Legion Post, including Carl Johansson. They'd like to establish a simple black and gray granite monument with two stone parts at Eaton Square next to Sandwich Town Hall.
Can you give us a sense of how many veterans there are from this war or overall on the Cape?
Well, in Sandwich, there are approximately 1,500 veterans, and a good many of them are Vietnam veterans, Johansson said, although he didn't say exactly how many. Now, in the U.S., nearly 60,000 service members died in the Vietnam conflict, but Johansson did not know of any from Sandwich. But Susan James, who's the chairwoman of the Sandwich Board of Selectmen, says there seems to be memorials for almost everything else, but nothing for the Vietnam War, and people would really like to mark this era in American history, a very important era.
I thought it was interesting that there's no hard and fixed dates for the beginning of this war, or it's referred to as a Vietnam War era memorial.
Yeah, but Johansson said that the veterans came up with the idea after President Obama issued a proclamation in 2012. President Obama declared the period from May 28, 2012 to November 11th, 2025 as a commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War. So that's a pretty big time frame there.
And Sandwich lost. I'm sorry. Did Sandwich lose any servicemen in the Vietnam War? Do you know?
Johansson said he did not know of any people who were lost from Sandwich.
What happens next with the memorial now?
Well, they've done preliminary presentations before the Sandwich Historical Commission already and went to the Sandwich Board of Selectmen. Next week, they go to the Community Preservation Committee.
We're going to take a look right now at the news that a right whale washed up on Nantucket, the carcass of a right whale. And it's just been a devastating year for the endangered right whale population. Tell us about this latest.
Yeah, it's this very sad story. This may be the 17th North Atlantic right whale to die in this year in Canadian and U.S. waters, and it was found on Sunday in Matticut Harbor. And basically, researchers are trying to figure out if this is a new whale or if it's a whale that was found and studied out to sea and then just left to drift, and whether they're studying drift patterns to see if this whale has actually, they've already studied, has just drifted back to land.
So when this story first came out and I heard it and I was thinking, well, how could they not know if this is a new whale or a whale that they've already sighted? But then the picture, if you look at the picture that you guys ran in the paper and that comes from the the fisheries service of that whale carcass, there's not much there at all.
No, it's very decomposed. As a matter of fact, the International Fund for Animal Welfare said that they can't determine the cause of death. And because they could get killed by, you know, they get killed by boat strikes. They get killed when they get entangled in this fishing line that is this new rope that is so strong they can't break free of. There are many ways for them to die out there. And what's really sad is that this is just, it's the worst year on record for this endangered species, regardless of whether it's the 17th or 16th whale to die.
I know that researchers are concerned that really we're watching this species go extinct before our eyes.
Yeah, the population has been declining since 2010. There were only 5 documented calf births this year. So that means, you know, the death rate is far out pacing the birth rate. And, you know, scientists are calling it, you know, a catastrophe, and just and they're using the words extinction, which is, you know, pretty scary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And probably happening rapidly, like in a matter of years.
Right. Or... Yeah. They said that this problem has to be addressed now. We don't have decades. We have years to address this. And the estimate of the female, how many reproductive, well, the estimate of the population is 451, with 105 reproductive females. And if the deaths continue at the same rate, those females will be gone in about 23 years.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker with Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we're going to hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And a little later, we'll hear from Josh Bowling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. In just a few minutes, we're going to hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Josh Bowling at the Nantucket and Inquirer and Mirror. Cindy, a report out this week had a lot of people talking. According to what it said, Barnstable County has the highest rate of heavy drinking in the state.
Yeah, that's according to a study by the financial news service 24/7 Wall Street. The study is called Alcohol Abuse, the Drunkest City in Every State, although they were really looking at, for Barnstable, it wasn't the town of Barnstable, it was the county of Barnstable. And according to this report, 21.5% of Cape Cod adults drink heavily. That's 4 or more drinks in a single occasion for women and 5 or more for men. And that's compared to the national average of 18% of American adults.
So the thinking here is what are they seeing in this?
Well, they're comparing it with other states. And for instance, Tennessee, 11.2% of residents consume excessively. The biggest drinkers are from Green Bay, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. where 26.5% of residents engage in heavy drinking. And the Cape numbers mirror findings by the Massachusetts Bureau of Substance Abuse Services, which reports treatment admissions for alcohol as the primary substance were 14% higher in Barnstable County than Massachusetts overall. Now, what our reporter Casey Myers talked to Austerville native and sculptor David Lewis, who is 76, and he's known for his bronze statues of John F. Kennedy and Mercy Otis Warren and Hyannis and Barnstable. And he said that he drank heavily in his younger years as a deckhand and plumber. He said that drinking is considered a rite of passage on Cape Cod.
Mm-hmm.
And he credited his wife of 54 years, Nancy, for saying she would leave with the kids unless he attended 12-step meetings. And he credits her for his sobriety. And it's interesting because there have been discussions about, you know, winter on the Cape and people, you know, not having the seasonal work that they have in the summer. Or there's also talk about, you know, retirees, or, you know, that sometimes there could be a feeling of a sense of purposeless mixed in. And it's interesting because Provincetown had the highest admission rate for substance abuse of alcohol. That was 1,768 per 100,000 population. That's, of course, there's 100,000 population,
yeah,
but that's how the statistics work. And Sandwich was the lowest with 793 per 100,000 population. Raymond Tomasi, who's a retired president of Goslow and Cape Cod, said that might be, figures might be a little bit skewed for the Cape because Cape also, when it comes to treatment beds, because Cape also has a relatively high number of treatment beds.
Well, it does certainly highlight, as we talk about the opioid epidemic so much these days, that alcoholism remains a real challenge to deal with here.
Yeah. Opiates are getting so much attention, as they should. But Barnstable County report says 135 people died of alcohol-related problems in 2013. And that's more than the record 78 opioid deaths in 2016.
Mm. We're going to speak now with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
George, you have a story. This is a really terrific story, I think, about a young woman who lost her leg in a moped accident a couple of years ago, last year, and she came back to the island to thank the first responders who treated her.
Yeah, that's right. We're talking about Noelle Lambert, and she was injured in a moped accident, got a lot of attention because she lost her leg in that really horrific accident. And yes, last week she came back to the island to talk with the first responders, who she credits with saving her life and also giving her the ability to come back from this injury, which was pretty horrific. Obviously, you know, she gives some incredible details in this story about what happened that day. And, you know, she was alert throughout this whole thing. She talks about...
she spoke to her mother on the cell phone while she was lying on the street.
Right, right. She gets on the phone telling her mother... And she actually insisted on talking to her mother because someone she thought was giving her mother bad information about her. And she said, I want to get on the phone with her. And she said, Mom, I'm fine. I've lost my leg. I've got to go. And she had to go because, you know, they had to rush her, obviously, to the hospital and then off island to save her life. She was a gifted athlete prior to this on the UMass Lowell lacrosse team. And she fully expects to get back on the field this spring, which is just incredible. She has what she calls her running leg, and you know, which will allow her to get back on the field. She says she's only lost like
a second.
Amount,
yeah,
a second off her 100-yard dash, which is incredible. You know, just to give listeners a little window into how she's dealt with all this. She says she has a pretty dark sense of humor. She talks about how she's dressed up at for Halloween in a big blue box and took a picture while without her prosthetic and called herself an IHOP, you know, after the Pancake House, of course. You know, so it is incredible. It's an uplifting story. I really recommend that folks go to our website and take a look at this, and you'll wonder to yourself, you know, what am I worrying about? I have a cold. I stubbed my toe. You know, this person has just such an inspiring story.
It is inspiring, and the momentum with which she has apparently gone through this and come out to this other place is just it is inspiring. Yes.
One of the things that mention about that is she did get some help along the way from victims of the Boston Marathon bombing who had reached out to her and talked to her about what it's like to live without one of your limbs. And so that's a nice aspect of this story as well.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve. Take care.
We are going to step over right now to Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, a planned affordable housing apartment complex on the island is prompting some concerns from neighbors. Sounds like the issue may be going to town meeting?
It possibly is. The town-backed affordable apartment complex, a 64-unit apartment complex, of which about 80% will be affordable based on Nantucket's affordability guidelines, was approved by the planning board earlier this week on Monday. It's 64 units, so 1, 2, 3 and studio apartments on town-owned land in the middle of the island off Fairgrounds Road next to the public safety complex and a soon-to-be-built fire station. And it's got 82 vehicle parking lot. There'll be some other improvements in and around the area. But neighbors have been expressing some concerns about the density, the size, and the traffic impacts of the project for the last month or so. And they said they haven't decided whether they're going to appeal to Land Court or not yet, but one of the leaders of the neighborhood organization, the neighbors that are opposing this, has filed a couple of town meeting articles to scuttle the project in particular and then delay any others that are either funded with public money or on public land for at least 7 years.
What can you tell us? You have another great story I want to ask you about, Josh, about Nantucket, how well represented the island's going to be on the Jamaican national lacrosse team.
Yes, this is another uplifting story, I think. it's not something you'd necessarily expect. athletes from Nantucket on the Jamaican national lacrosse team. Most people probably don't even know that lacrosse is played on Jamaica, but there's a sizable Jamaican population, both year-round and seasonal on the island. There has been for a couple of decades now. A lot of Jamaican families have come to the island to participate in the service economy, and many have stayed. And the children of a lot of those people have been in the school system for a good 15, 20 years now, and Nantucket has quite a good high school lacrosse team, one of the better small school high school lacrosse teams in southern Massachusetts, and a bunch of students, athletes with Jamaican heritage have played, and they all tried out for and made the Jamaican national lacrosse team that's going to be participating in the World Lacrosse Championships this summer in Israel. So there's five players and an assistant coach all going down to they could be in Jamaica, and then they're going to go to Israel and participate in the World Championships. And coaches and the administrators say they don't know that there is any other team in the championships that has as many students from a single school as Nantucket's going to have on that Jamaican national lacrosse team.
From one island to another. It's going to be a fun time this summer as people follow this competition.
There is. There have been already been some comparisons to Cool Runnings, the movie about the Jamaican bobsled team. But at least the weather is conducive to playing lacrosse on Jamaica. You can find a place in a couple of fields to play lacrosse a little easier than you can find a bobsled run in Jamaica.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Steve Junker. This is the News Roundup. We are with Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com. Cindy, a popular snack bar at Nauset Beach, a longtime tradition for beachgoers there, it could be seeing the end. Tell us about this.
Orleans Selectmen have decided to let the concession contract for Liam's at Nauset Beach to expire in 3 years. And John Owen, who's had the lease there since 1990, wanted to have a modular snack bar that can be moved back from the beach as winter storms increasingly erode the shore. But the town is saying, no, we think we want to get rid of the old building there, and the building has been there for decades, and replace it with mobile food units such as food trucks.
So he wanted to have what was the problem with building a modular snack bar like he proposed?
Well, the price tag was one problem, according to the Orleans Board of Selectmen Chairman John Fuller. They might have had to, anchor it with pilings and then move it, and they said that would just be, too great an expense.
And what's his response to the idea of having a mobile operation?
Well, Omen said that he helps the town get $100,000 in revenue each year from Liam's. And he said the food truck just wouldn't be as profitable. He said he's had a food truck in the past, and it's just not as profitable. The problem, of course, with Nauset is the erosion. Its erosion rates have increased dramatically since the early 1990s, and now 12 feet a year. And this is Atlantic. Facing Barrier Beach. It's 12 miles long, but unfortunately the weakest area is the parking lot and administration and restroom and concession buildings.
So the Orleans, I know that Orleans did a management plan a little while ago to take a look at what the overall picture is. Is this part of that?
Yeah, a 2016 report recommends that the town establish a mobile restroom and concession facilities in Nauset Beach within 5 years and also move its beach administration offices back from the water as well so it doesn't get washed away.
Well, we'll be following that. It's a tradition out there, and if Liam's goes away, I don't know what a lot of folks are going to do.
That's right.
We have a story by Jeff Spillane in the paper today about soil that appears to have a level of contamination, was removed from the Cape's airport, and now there's some question about where that soil has gone.
Right, and how badly contaminated it is. This was, as you mentioned, soil excavated during the Barnes Municipal Airport project, and most of it has been removed. The contaminant was found, but not before most of it was removed elsewhere, and this is including temporarily to a west Barnesville ball field. This was approximately 120,000 cubic yards of soil was unearthed during the reconstruction project of a runway that began in March and ended in October. And the Department of Environmental Protection has raised concerns about potential perfluorinated chemicals in the soil.
So the soil was removed and it was taken away, and they're concerned about where it might have been ended up?
Yes. Well, right now it's, for instance, Lawrence Lynch. It's not sure where. They know where some of it is, and some of it was actually at the West Ball Field for a little bit, but it was considered not to, it was going to be used in the construction of a parking lot, but it was not considered to be good soil for the parking lot, so that was moved. And a contract, Lawrence Lynch and probably at some contractors have removed soil, but 90,000 cubic yards ended up at Cape Cod Aggregates in Hyannis. A pile of undetermined quantity remains at the airport, but we don't know where all of it is.
Concerning. We have a nice story from Doug Frazier this week, a story about a young woman at Barnstable High School, a student who's kind of devoted herself to taking on the issue of food waste.
Yeah, well, think of the hundreds of pounds of food waste that's tossed in Barnstable High School's cafeteria each week. Barnstable High School senior Allison Carter did, and it bothered her a lot. As part of an AP Environmental Science course, Carter and her classmate Cameron Roberts-Capick worked with the Cape Cod Challenger Club to install a food composter at the high school.
What is a composter? Explain for us, because I hadn't seen this before.
Well, this is not like composting like happens outside,
right?
There was just like too much food to like bring up to establish a little compost heap at Barnstable High School. Also, this composter, it's a machine. It's like the size of an oversized washing machine. It's capable of reducing 65 pounds of food waste to about 7 pounds of dry compost that resembles a cross between coffee grounds and mulch. This is a stainless steel composter, and Carter flipped the switch on it in October. And the interesting thing about it also is that it doesn't just take vegetable food items. It can also take dairy and meat and paper products.
There is a lot of food waste apparently going on. This article really details the amount of food waste within the school system.
Yeah, at Barnstable High School alone, it's 100 to 200 pounds of food per day. Now, the Cape Cod Challenger Club provides programs and activities for adults and children with disabilities, and they paid $21,000 for the composter with a stipulation that the school develop and maintain a program incorporating special needs children in the running of the this program.
And then the article really does go on to talk about food waste reclamation efforts all around the region. I know Stop and Shop built a food waste recovery plant, and there's a lot of information here.
Yeah, and there's a ton of information, including the information that Americans waste about 300 pounds of food waste per year. So that's a lot of waste, and it's getting worse. It's getting worse in our disposable society. Also, Allison Carter's, she is spreading the word. She'd like to see more composters at more schools, and she's actually gone up and she's done a presentation at the Chatham Bars Inn. Herb Montgomery, he's the co-owner of an Orleans firm that markets what is called the EcoVim composter that's in use at Barnstable High School now, said that he went along with Carter to give her support, but he needn't have bothered. He said, "I was blown away. She did a fantastic job, and the Chatham company decided on a pilot program."
That's wonderful. What a good effort by this young woman from Barnstable High School.
Yeah.
That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guests, Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com. Thank you, Cindy.
You're welcome.
And thanks to our other contributors. We heard from Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Ann Wood at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.